Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Katz, the host for this episode. Today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Vicky Brennan about her book, Singing Yoruba Christianity, Music, Media, and Morality, which was published by Indiana University Press in 2018. Dr. Brennan is an associate professor of religion at the University of Vermont. Dr. Brennan, welcome to New Books.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I know you have a background in ethnomusicology as well as anthropology, so it certainly makes sense that you would land on a topic related to music. But how did you become interested in Nigeria, and then sort of how did you narrow down your interest in terms of church music?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I have to say that my interest in Nigeria and in this topic is entirely due to sort of personal relationships and contacts. So when I started my master's degree in ethnomusicology, I actually, as part of the program of study, we had to learn a music tradition that was not an American music tradition or a Western music tradition. And so the Nigerian musician Ike Dairo, he's a pop musician who most Nigerians will know who he is. He's a super famous Nigerian juju musician. He was in residence at the University of Washington my first year as a graduate student, you know, fresh out of college. So I had the great fortune, the amazing opportunity to study with him that first year of graduate work. So Ike Dairo was, you know, both this kind of musical inspiration for me. I learned about Nigerian music through that contact, but he was also a leader in the Cherubim and Seraphim churches in Nigeria. And so that was sort of how I stumbled onto this project. It was, you know, both through my regular contact with him and also Chris Waterman, who was teaching at the University of Washington at that time, who was, of course, responsible for bringing Ike Dairo to the U.S. to teach, you know, students how to play juju music. He was like, Vicky, you know, this would be a great project. You should think about it. So it's through that kind of connection. And it was always like, I'm going to go to Nigeria so I can study in Baba's church. And unfortunately, he passed away before I was even able to go to Nigeria for the first time. But I have visited his church in the Lawanson area of Nigeria, of Lagos, multiple times. And so it really comes out of that very personal, close connection I had during my first year of graduate studies.
Yeah, that's lucky. So I was hoping you might share a bit more about your research methods. And if you could kind of comment on, you know, whether your methods changed over the course of working on the project.
Yes. Yeah. That you. My guest has also entered the chat, so I'll just note the cat. So I am trained as an anthropologist and an ethnomusicologist, which means I primarily use ethnographic methods. Intention. I mean, this is how most ethnomusicologists, particularly when I was trained, approach their study, was to, you know, sort of embed yourself within a musical community and learn how to play the music, how to perform the music in some way. So I was able to join the choir of the Ionio Church in Lagos, which is, I mean, there's a story there, which I won't go into. I had to go through a lengthy process, though, to be able to be invited to join the choir without having done their whole baptismal classes and all that kind of stuff. But they were really generous in inviting me to join the choir. So part of what I did during my 2 years of field research with the church in Lagos was to sing with the choir. I went to choir practice twice a week, to the regular worship services on Sunday. I had to attend Bible study classes and other functions. I took talking drum lessons with the church's lead drummer, just to have a little bit of an understanding of how the talking drum works within the musical practices of the choir. And then I also did, I had visited a great deal. I had spent 6 months doing research prior to joining the choir. So I visited other churches. So I had a comparative basis for the study. Yeah, sorry about the little distraction there. But then I did in-depth interviews with a number of the elders in the church. And then I also tried to identify folks, sort of regular, everyday sort of church members that would be worth doing life histories or case studies on. So I did a variety of those kinds of, you know, it's like participant observation, learning how to perform the music, interviews. I surveyed the choir. I didn't survey the church because it's a quite large church, but I did do a survey of the choir about their musical preferences and practices. And so it's a sort of mix of all of those things. In terms of how did it change, I think one thing I will say is that I did want to do some archival research in Nigeria. And the times when I was there for this particular research, so it was the early 2000s, it was very difficult for me to gain access to archives. During those 2 years, I would say the universities in Lagos, the lectures were on strike pretty much the entire time. Libraries weren't really open, though I was able to use some of the UI. University of Ibadan Library Archives. So the archival side of it wasn't quite as full as I intended. And then perhaps that's okay though, because it's, you know, the project went in a different direction.
Also too, you at some points mention sharing your research and even your whole dissertation with members of the church. So I was wondering kind of what were the moments in which you kind of sought out feedback directly for what you had been written, and kind of how did that change kind of the direction or?
Yeah, well, that's actually what's always was so, that was so interesting to me, because it was really important for me to have feedback. I didn't want it to just be a sort of drop in, do a study, and then write a book kind of thing. But I really wanted to have it be this engaged, dialogic anthropology, dialogic ethnography. And so I would share works or chapters in progress with a few key members of the choir, including the choir master, who is now actually the general leader of the church. That's the focus of the book. So he read, I sent him drafts. He would give me more general feedback on it. There was one of the choir members who now leads his own church in Lagos, but he read a lot of the chapters and he helped me with some of the Yoruba translations as well. So he gave me feedback on the general direction of the text. The current, the person who's the current head master of the choir, who's actually based in New York City, I sent him the entire manuscript and he read it. And then within the Ionio Church, there's an English chapel, and one of the members of the English chapel is actually a professor of linguistics at Lagos State University. And so he actually read the text as well and gave me feedback on it. And what was interesting to me about all of this feedback is that it was like, oh yes, you really, like, it was very positive, very encouraging. And then it would usually end by telling me, you're not criticizing us enough. Tell us what we're doing wrong, which was interesting to me. I think, you know, obviously I don't see ethnography as deciding who's doing Christianity right or wrong. But it was interesting to me as an ethnographic point in terms of what they were interested in terms of their focus on their worship practices. And so I think that some of that does make it into the manuscript.
All right. So now let's get into the book. So to start, for our listeners who might not be kind of very familiar with this topic, can you provide just like a little background on the Cherubim and Seraphim Church?
Yeah. So the Cherubim and Seraphim are a group of churches that across the African continent are often referred to as African independent churches in Nigeria, or especially in the Yoruba region of Nigeria. They're often referred to as Aladura churches. And these are churches that broke off from mission churches in the early 1900s, like late 1800s, early 1900s, to develop into Africanized forms of Christian practice. They understood themselves to be independent from the sort of Catholic Church or the Anglican Church. And what's distinct about the Aladura churches and the Cherubim and Seraphim churches in particular, that they're known in Southwest Nigeria for being white garment churches. They wear white robes to worship in. They incorporated a lot of very sort of distinctive musical styles into their worship practices, hence my book. And they also the role of church prophets, prophecy and prophets in the church is something that's often seen as distinctive about the Aladura churches. So the Cherubim and Seraphim Church is one of a handful of different Aladura churches. It's one of the sort of three main Aladura churches in Southwest Nigeria.
So you kind of begin by laying out how sort of the act of all sort of singing the same song together in church and, you know, singing it properly is central to the ability of the church to, you know, literally bring the Holy Spirit into the space of the church. So can you explain kind of how that works?
Yeah. So what the main argument or the main purpose of the book is to show how church members draw on a variety of media, song, dance, bodily comportment, dressing the body, etc., in order to recreate an idealized space of heaven that is a space within which proper moral forms of behavior can be enacted, and that becomes sanctified through the presence of the Holy Spirit. So if you engage in all of these media correctly, you're transforming the self so that it's one that's more open to the presence of the Holy Spirit. And it's also one that's more likely for the Holy Spirit to enter into. Yeah. And so it is really through the kind of manipulation of all of these different kind of media forms, dressing the body in white, singing the particular kinds of songs in a certain sort of style according to the right kinds of performance practices, moving together, the groupness of it, if it's about singing the same song, right, that implies a kind of groupness of it. All of that is about achieving a certain kind of ideal self, community, and moral behavior.
And then where do the kind of the different hymns come from, particularly those that were sort of produced by Nigerians throughout the church's history?
Yeah, so there's a number of different songs that are sung in the church. And some of them, as you kind of, I think your question implies, is some of them are hymns that are taken from Anglican churches, Western churches, a variety of different Christian hymnals. But many of them are also composed in the church, the Aladra or the Cherubim and Seraphim churches themselves by church members. So there's hundreds, if not thousands of them. It's a large, lengthy compendium of songs. So some of them are, there's some hymns that are distinctly identified as having been composed by the charismatic founder of the church back in the early 1900s, Moses Orimolade, and other of his followers in that time during the founding moment of the church. But throughout the 20th century, songs were composed. Some of them made their way into the Cherubim and Seraphim handbook, and I talk about that a bit in one of the chapters of the text. But songs continue to be composed, and they'll incorporate different kinds of musical styles. They're often usually based on some sort of biblical inspiration, and infrequently composers receive songs through a sort of Holy Spirit inspiration. So often they come while people are asleep or in dreams, and the Holy Spirit arrives. And as part of the lesson that they're, you know, sort of they receive a message from God through this intervention. And often the lesson ends up in, you know, they receive it in the form of a song that they can then teach to others. And I actually describe at length in the book, one of the chapters of the book, a sort of dream that the choir master had that resulted in a set of two songs that became the first commercial recording made by the Ioneo Church in Lagos.
Yeah, I also found it interesting how it was really a kind of group effort to write a lot of these songs. Even if one person has the dream, it's not necessarily that they're doing all of the writing of the music. But
yeah. I mean, the what's interesting, and this is actually, I know we'll talk a little bit later about my what I'm working on right now, but so much of musical learning and professionalization of musicians in Southwest Nigeria, in perhaps Southern Nigeria more generally, is happening in the church. So people are singing in church for their religious purposes, but they're also learning how to play music. And then that is coming out of the church, right? So my discovery of this research project through meeting Ike Dairo is pointing to that, right? He's this popular music superstar who also learned how to play in the church. He extends out of the church through his popular music, but he also brings it back into the church through his religious practice.
And then, you know, as you discuss, you know, music is sort of not only central to the facilitation of prayer and religious experience, but it also kind of helps connect members to the history of the church, particularly in terms of the official hymnal. So kind of how does music kind of reference backward to the past?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the things that church members see music as doing, is that it is a way, if you sing the same song that your ancestors sung or that those who came before you sung, and you sing it in the right way. And the question of the right way is always one that's up for debate. Like that's sort of what I try to trace through the various discussions in the text. But if you sing that in the right way, then you're able to connect to that wisdom of your elders, of your ancestors, and bring it into the present so it can be used. And in one of the chapters of the text, I do talk at length about a particular ceremony performed in the church on Holy Michael's Day, which is a celebration of the founding of the church by the original members of the church. in which they explicitly sing songs that are understood both to have been composed by the founders of the church, but also to have been inspirational of the founding of the church. And so I talk about in that chapter how it's actually Onward Christian Soldiers is one of the key hymns of that day that's sung, right? Which is a song, I mean, this is a way of expanding one's ancestral, like who is one's ancestors, who is one's history, and then how does singing that in the present moment connect you to that past and allow you to bring those lessons forward?
One thing I was wondering here was whether you observed kind of any generational differences in how members related to the past, or whether kind of the regular repetition of certain historically rooted songs sort of helped prevent those, you know, intergenerational tensions, perhaps.
Yeah, I think actually generation is a really important part of the book's argument that perhaps I don't do enough with in the writing, because I think that's explicitly what's at stake in so many of the debates about what is the right way to sing this song and what is the right song to sing in this particular moment. And while I was doing my research, I did this sort of focus 2 years of very focused ethnographic field research, and then I would go back. I've been visiting the church pretty regularly for the past 20 years now, which is sort of kind of blows my mind a little bit. Or follow debates on social media and other media forums, and it is about making sure that young people understand the importance of history and of proper forms of behavior, both like bodily comportment as well as moral or ethical orientations towards society, towards the world. But I think it was, many of the controversies that arose were about like how to navigate a new generation who desires to be a leader in the church, for example. I mean, that was one of the big debates. And part of what happened in the Ionio church. So this has been, let me just take a step back and say, this has been something that's characterized cherubim and seraphim churches from the very beginning. If you look at the early studies of that particular church, there's sociological studies or historical studies written by Nigerian as well as by British scholars. It notes that there's a lot of schisms, right? That the cherubim and seraphim church is constantly breaking into new denominations or new groups. Much of that has to do with generational difference and the desire for a certain kind of religious authority. And the Ionio church has navigated that divide in various kinds of ways. When I was doing my research there, the big threat or what was perceived by church leaders as a big threat was the loss of younger people to neo-Pentecostal churches. And so it was a debate about how to liven or transform worship practices to ensure that young people didn't leave for these other churches that appeared to be newer or modern or whatever. I think that it's complicated in terms of whether it worked or not. I don't think I'm the person to answer that. But I think what's interesting is the way that they would develop new sort of fellowships within the church. And I'll note that the choir that I worked with was connected to what was called the main church in this particular. So this is a very large mega church, not as big perhaps as Redeemed Church of God or some of the other big Nigerian mega churches, but it's a big church, especially by the Aladra standards, the white garment church standards. And within the church compound every Sunday, there'd be three or four different fellowships worshiping in separate spaces. And they were the main division was based on age. So when I was doing the bulk of my research, 2002 to 2004, I did my work in the main church, which mainly included church members older than 40, I would say. So I was actually too young at that time to really, they were like, well, you're kind of young, but you should come sing with us. And then the youth fellowship was for young adults, basically people between the age of 20 and 40. And then after I left, there was an even further fracturing, where, you know, as people aged out of the youth fellowship, they didn't feel like they belonged in the main church, even though they had aged up there. So there was a middle fellowship created. And I think that that's part of, like, there's an acknowledgement that different generations want to worship differently, that circumstances, social circumstances, economic circumstances, political circumstances are different depending on when you're trying to make your life, to have your career and your family. And so there were different kinds of religious needs. The church fracturing into two churches, they just developed these fellowships within the church. But I think that that's really the challenge, or that's sort of what I try to trace in the book, which is how do you maintain this connection to the past when the present is changing so rapidly, to ensure a future that resembles the past. So I think that that's part of what they're trying to use music to do. If you can sing the same song that the founder of the church sang, then you will have that connection, even if you're singing it in a very different kind of context than Moses or Mlade sang. He was singing in the colonial period, the period of British colonialism. Now it's a very different moment.
A topic that comes up at different moments of the book is how media of recorded music has facilitated and changed many aspects of kind of the day-to-day functioning of the church, which you've kind of already alluded to a bit. And it's also kind of crucial to its popularity. That's kind of how you ended up, studying this church in part. So to start, you describe how the 1978 recording by the Aeonio Church branch was kind of key to its founding and justified itself both in terms of history as well as the present context of Nigeria's oil boom. So, I mean, how does it manage to kind of accomplish all of that with sort of one cassette tape?
Well, I'm not sure it accomplishes it just with the cassette tape, but I think the cassette is this really interesting lens into which we can see how the church navigates these kinds of generational differences we've talked about, and to maintain continuity with the past, but also change in relationship to a transformed present. And I think, as I describe in the chapter, it really lines up with their sort of desire for, or their perceived understanding of the evangelical purpose of the church to reach new Christians, to reach Christians. And also for their interest in sort of creating this compelling music and sharing it with people. And so I think that the cassette tape, they did initially record it. I think it was initially pressed in vinyl, but that was quickly, that particular technology, because of the transformations, the external transformations of sound recording and distribution technology more generally, quickly became eclipsed by the cassette, right? It enabled these songs to move outside of the space of the church. And this was recognized as something that was going to be good. Even if it's people who aren't going to come to church, they're still going to hear the message. They're still going to be able to sing the same song. And then we will be able to recreate outside of the church the sort of ideals of the moral community. And so I think the ways that these different kinds of musical technologies enable wider circulation as well as transformation is really... It is really worth noting. And some of the project I'm currently working on is actually expanding on that side of the argument a little bit more. But I think, let's, we can stick to, yeah.
Sure. And then later chapters in the book kind of come back to the sort of importance of recorded sound, you know, produced by the church. So what are some of the different ways that kind of ordinary church members, as well as members of the choir, incorporate recorded hymns into their daily lives?
Yeah, well, I think that having a recording of a particular song really changes the way that you can think about what it means to sing the same song, right? We don't have a recording, for example, of Moses Orimolade singing a song that he, the founder of the church, was, right, singing a song in the style he would have sung it. We have to recreate it through sort of repeated practice over time, transmission across generations. But when you have a recording, you have an actual instance of a performance of a song that then can set the standard for what it means to sing the same song. And so what I, you know, one of the things that I observed was the challenges that that presented. If you take a song that's recorded on one of the church's, you know, commercial recordings on one of their cassettes and now their CDs. And I mean, I'm guessing now that they stream. I know that they stream. And you have to recreate it in a live worship performance. What does it mean then to sing the same song? Do you sing it exactly as it was on the recording? Do you adapt it because you're singing it in a new moment that has different challenges or different contexts, and how is that negotiated? And so part of what I try to, I mean, this is where I feel like we talked a bit about my methods earlier. Like, this is really where the ethnography becomes very sort of complicated. Like, this is where ethnography becomes necessary to even understand it, because it's about bringing together these different ideas of what it means. And so I do talk a little bit about how for members of the choir, especially when they're practicing the songs that are already well known by them, they have to learn how to sing it in a way that's both recognizes or acknowledges the past performance of the song, but also is speaking to their current situation. And, you know, I describe a case where the director that day stops the practice to say, like, no, you're not really singing it. You have to feel it. And once you feel it and you connect it to yourself, then you've sung the song. Like, you can't just enjoy it because you know the song and you know how to sing it. And I think that gets at the some of the work, like, to point to how religious orientations to the world are really about these repeated, learned, and practiced embodied practices. Yeah.
And then sort of beyond, you know, listening to the recordings and practicing, how do other types of bodily discipline, as well as a sort of sartorial tradition and organization of the space within the church, how do these all kind of work along with the music to help members sort of feel the Holy Spirit during the church service?
Yeah, one of the key arguments of the book is that it is about all of, you know, it's this multimedia, highly sensationalized form that draws together smell, sight, taste, touch, as well as sound in order to achieve these sorts of bodily ways of being in the world that exemplify moral orientations towards each other, and ways of being. And so I think wearing the white church uniform is a key part of that. Again, that it connects back to what we talked about in terms of generational differences. Certainly, I think that for many, there's a debate about, is this too old fashioned? What does it really mean? As opposed to the argument made by a number of members of the church of a variety of ages that, no, this, once you put this this uniform on, you are transformed. You're no longer merely your sort of everyday profane form, quote unquote profane form, but you become sacralized through it. And I would often be told, I mean, I'll have to admit, so I did wear the white church uniform. I mean, I had to in order to sing in the choir. But I was very, what I'm admitting is that it often made me uncomfortable to be out and about outside of the church in the white uniform, because it made me even more noticeable than I already was on the streets. I mean, I would be stopped, you know, people would stop and stare, or people would just stop and say, "What are you doing? What is this? What is going on?" And so I would often try to just change before I left the church compound. And a lot of people did that. It's not like I was doing something out of the ordinary, but people would say, "What are you doing? You have to keep your church uniform on. It's going to protect you. Like, this will provide the protection, that, you know, that way you won't have any car accidents on your way home. You won't be stopped by the police. Nothing will harm you. You'll get home safely. We insist you keep your uniform on." And I think that is, you know, that points to the way that this is not just about putting on a dress, but it's about transforming the self in line with these ideals of the church that also has this efficacious, it does this efficacious work in the world, right? That's why, how it performs or it creates this protective shield. And so it's part of all of that, the uniform, knowing how to sing the songs, knowing how to sing them the right way, knowing how to move the body, recognizing the sound of the right way to pray, all of that comes together, then allows one to be the right kind of person in the world, to be able to claim one's blessings, right? To achieve prosperity, to ensure a good future for your community.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like: no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In your epilogue, you note that kind of new media, from cell phones to Facebook, have presented new platforms for religious music. I particularly found the debate over whether to put a hymn as a kind of musical callback feature on people's cell phones to be really interesting. So can you talk a little bit about kind of how church elders sort of decide how to regulate the use of new media as it relates to church music?
Well, I mean, I think this is one of these interesting debates, right? That for me leads to a real understanding of how past and present get reconciled, about how generational difference is both produced as well as overcome. It's, in terms of an actual procedure, they have lots of meetings. Like, that's literally how it's done. And they will talk about it a lot. I actually wasn't really privy to the meetings about the callbacks. But I think it was about sort of, what does this technology mean? You know, similar to the way, like, deciding to record the church's music and distribute on cassettes, right? What does it mean that this can be accessible in a space where you might not be in a mode to pray or to worship? And I think that you know, it both points to the way that they understand the power, the efficacious religious power of the songs themselves, and the impact that they can have on a person who has been sort of properly entrained to have a bodily response to those kinds of sounds. I think the one that was most controversial while I was in the field was about whether or not they should have a sort of closed caption screen that would put the words of the hymns at the front of the church rather than requiring everybody to have a hymn book. And at that time, the leaders of the church were strongly against the closed captioning system in favor of, I mean, they saw it as promoting literacy. If everybody has their hymnal, then they can read the hymns and then they can actually study them on their own as, you know, the words of the hymns themselves, like at home. I will say now that they do have the closed caption televisions that broadcast the hymns. And in fact, I mean, they're constantly evolving their use of technology. So you can actually watch, and this is in part because of the pandemic, they live stream their worship services every Sunday on YouTube. So I can go up on YouTube and anybody could go and watch the worship services from the Ionio Church, right? And so it is a constant process of transformation, incorporation of new technologies. It has to be done right. I think that's the sort of ethnographic observation, is that you do it in the right way, and then it can accomplish the intended ends. It would be interesting to know about the deliberations that went into deciding to live stream the services, but I would guess it had a lot to do with wanting to protect the members of the church at the same time as making available collective worship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Another theme that arises in several chapters of the book is that there's sort of both an embrace and kind of emphasis on how certain aspects of the church kind of reflect Yoruba culture. But then there's also an effort at the same time to make clear that the church is entirely Christian. And members even kind of criticize other churches for allowing indigenous religious beliefs to sort of creep in. So what Yoruba cultural values and sort of practices, you know, does the church highlight? And then where does it sort of draw a boundary in order to distinguish itself from other churches in Lagos?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really great question. It's super complicated. And again, this is something that you have to really turn to, right? This isn't a right or wrong answer. It's an answer that's developed ethnographically and by different kinds of actors for different purposes. So most church members would say, we are a Yoruba church because, and if I would say, why do you think you're a Yoruba church? It would be about the importance of hierarchical relationships based on age. So this is where generation becomes this really important theme, right? That you honor your elders, that junior people know their position in relationship to elders, but that also elders know the obligations that they have towards those who come after them to care for, to help, to educate, to nurture, all of that stuff. Almost every church member I asked, if I said, what makes this church a Yoruba church? That would be the answer. The other big part of it for most of the church members I talked to would be about language and other kinds of expressive forms. So I would talk to people who had left the church to join neo-Pentecostal denominations. And often they would express regret that, I like my new church, but I really miss praying in Yoruba, or I can't pray as well in English as I can in Yoruba, or the songs in this church are just so sweet because they know how to bring together the drums and the instruments and the voice so well. And I think that that's another site where the Yoruba-ness of Christianity becomes developed within the church. I would say, right. I think for me, religion isn't, right? Religion is what people do. And if Yoruba people are saying they're doing Christianity that is both Christian and Yoruba, I think I have to take them seriously and try to understand what it is that they see about that, right? So it would be the sort of importance of particular kinds of social relationships that get embedded in it, the use of these cultural forms. And then the reason why I'm going back to this kind of foundational understanding of this relationship is because the accusations about other churches not being properly Christian often points to practices that could be understood as the same, right? So this is really about the shifting nature of understanding insiders and outsiders within a particular community. Yeah.
Well, I guess, I mean, where do they draw the line, for example? Like, what would they sort of, view as, like, allowing, like, indigenous religion to kind of creep in?
So it would be, so specifically naming certain kinds of, certain deities, right? So they're using a lot of very culturally deep names to refer to the Christian God, but there's certain, like if it comes close to the way that certain Orisha are talked about, that becomes too close. Mm-hmm. I think one of the instances I talk about in the book is the lead drummer for the choir. He was like, well, look, I am a Christian and I'm Yoruba and I can play this drum. It's the bata drum. And it's the drum that's usually played for Shango, the Orisha Shango. But when I play it, I'm not drawing Shango down. I'm not like, you know, allowing people to be possessed by Shango. It's the Holy Spirit. And he laid a track, a bata track for one of the choir's recordings. And he said, yeah, they decided that they couldn't use it, that it was too potentially dangerous. Huh. Yeah. So it's, you know, I think that that's, but the, in popular culture, there's all kinds of, you know, sort of insinuations that white garment churches are sort of engaging in a little bit of fetishism, quote unquote fetishism or juju or whatever, when they use candles or soap or certain kinds of objects as the focus of their prayer that then is understood as not being about this kind of transparent, direct relationship to God. But what's interesting is, you know, you like those are certainly practices that are widely done in Aladara churches, cherubim and seraphim churches, but they're also done in Pentecostal churches. So really that's about who is making the accusation and for what purpose. That's a political claim. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another theme, which we've sort of already, you know, addressed a little bit, right, is this idea of, you know, increased competition with Pentecostal churches. One sort of question related to that I had while reading the book was that, you know, while it didn't seem kind of identical to sort of the typical prosperity gospel of many of the mega Pentecostal churches in Nigeria, there was clearly a message in the church that prayer, hard work, and sort of bodily discipline would lead to material success on earth. And in your final chapter, you note that sort of the most senior and revered group within the church are in part revered for their seniority, but also, you know, for their success in life. So sort of how do members maybe see this as different than the Pentecostal prosperity gospel?
So I think, I think that they would say, I think they have said that it's not, we've been doing this the whole time.
I see.
Yeah. And that this is just like the attraction for, like this is about competition and this is about the lure of the foreign or the new or the outside. Whereas if we really embrace our sort of our Yorubanness, the Yorubanness that's embedded in cherubim and seraphim Christianity, then you're doing the same thing. So that's one of like that's one of their defensive reactions to that. I mean, I would say also though it's complicated and contradictory because at the same time they want to be clear that they're really Christian and therefore everybody, not just Yoruba folks. And so that's why there's an English chapel within the compound. But I don't think that that is as convincing to many members of the church, especially to church leadership, as the argument that we've been doing this all along, but we're better because we're doing it in this Yoruba way as opposed to this foreign way. And it's actually like to be Yoruba, to practice religion, to practice Christianity in this Yoruba way is actually ethically better. Because neo-Pentecostals are appealing to these like foreign or outside influences.
And then on this note, kind of, you know, in what ways does the structure of the church kind of provide material support for members? And then kind of what is the sort of the limits to this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big, I mean, this is what Pentecostal churches, many of the Pentecostal churches in Nigeria are doing. And this church is no exception of, you know, the state has really withdrawn from providing social needs, you know, the social needs of the community. I mean, there's a healthcare clinic in the church compound. They do regular fundraising to give alms to needy, clothing drives. They often will negotiate conflicts between people, between church members and outsiders, because to go to sort of, you know, the police or other legal authority is often lengthy and involves a great deal of bribes and stuff. And so, I mean, I think that's one of the things that the church certainly does. And it's organized in a way within internally, in a way to make sure that you're, if you're a member of the church, you're very aware of your connections to others. And so I talk a bit about in the book about this Egbe, this system of they're kind of like clubs or they're just groupings. They're organized mostly according to spiritual directive. There's some based on age, and there's some based on gender. Well, they're actually all gendered, I should say. Sorry about that. They're all gendered. Some of them are mixed gender, but very few of them. But once you join the church, after a while, you join one of the bands, the clubs, and then you have this network of obligations, people who will care for you and who you are obligated to care for, so that if you have a problem, you can turn to. There's all kinds of, sort of microcredit loaning groups organized within the church. But it can also lead to situations of abuse, right? Where you become obligated in a way that extends beyond what you're capable of. And one of the things I ask at the end of the book, right, is how realistic is this, like, is this just as much productive of inequality as it is of equality, like the ideal of equality that's enshrined in like that these practices are trying to enshrine? Because it is about sort of wealth flowing up, which then is recirculated down. But given changing economic and political considerations in Nigeria, how much is that actually possible? So
good. Yeah, I have one last question kind of regarding Pentecostalism. You sort of note in the epilogue that you see your research as a, you know, corrective to the Pentecostal prejudice in studies of Christianity in Africa in the last two decades. So sort of, you know, what is this Pentecostal prejudice and kind of how is your book in conversation with it?
Yeah. I mean, this is, I guess, maybe me being a little defensive or even snarky myself. But I think, I mean, to be clear, I think it's a corrective to the overwhelming attention that primarily white Africanists paid to the sort of Pentecostal boom that happened starting in the 1990s. Through the current moment, and the way that I mean, that is a profound shift in religiosity in West Africa, mm-hmm. certainly. But I feel like the way that it was written about in a lot of sort of anthropology and historical writings, was very it was as though that was all that mattered. I mean, I would go to conferences and say what I was writing about, or I'd be on panels and people would say, oh, those churches still exist. And I was like, yeah, there's like 10,000 people who attend this one church in Lagos every Sunday. You know, and so I think that for me, this was a pushback against that, to say, yeah, let's pay attention to the new, but let's then understand how it's impacting the old, or what is causing the old, or what's still there to happen underneath it. So, and I feel like part of what I was pointing to there too is the way that those scholars, who in their need to make a sort of strong case for why what they're studying is important, actually reproduce the ideology of the community that they're studying, as opposed to really looking at it. Like, what does it mean when Pentecostals say, no, we are the ones that matter, as opposed to just scholars reproducing that kind of discourse. So,
That's interesting. Right. And now that you're speaking, I'm just sort of thinking, like, I haven't seen very much scholarship lately about Catholicism in Nigeria, even though I feel like I've been invited to Catholic services when I've been in Nigeria as much as any other.
Yeah, I would say that Nigeria is one of the centers of global Catholicism. And, you know, so I think that some of it was my defensiveness as being portrayed as like studying this like niche that doesn't really matter anymore, when of course it matters. And I do think it has to do with sort of more, it has to do with white Africanist interests and proclivities. I will say that most Nigerian scholars I meet are like, oh my gosh, you study what? That's so amazing. That's so important. And I appreciate that, because I do think it is this very important religious, cultural, and social phenomenon for Nigeria and for the Yoruba in particular.
And great. So now that we've sort of gone throughout kind of most of the book, although certainly there's more in there that we, you know, haven't had a chance to get into, but yeah. I'm wondering if you can kind of speak a bit to the process of sort of turning all of your research into a monograph. You know, was it clear kind of what would become a chapter, or were there sort of some chapters that maybe you started writing that kind of never made it into the book, or?
this question is, I mean, this is a hard one. It took me a long time to write this book. And, you know, some of it has to do with the obligations of teaching and being, a professor. And some of it had to do with me trying to figure out what I wanted to say. So the way that this book or this project was originally framed was that I was supposed to do about a year of field research in Nigeria, and then I was going to do a year of field research in churches here in the US, and I was going to look at that kind of this neo-diasporic connection. And that quickly, I mean, some of it was I got enough research funding to stay in Nigeria for another year, and some of it was, oh my gosh, I need, like, there's so much here that I need to understand first. So quickly, the stuff about the Cherubim and Seraphim churches in the U.S. kind of dropped out, but I do have an article that I published about that in the Journal of Religion in Africa. But I think for me, while I was writing this book, I was really interested in ritual and framing it in terms of ritual and what, you know, how music is this really key part of ritual. And I think in the writing that sort of gradually was transformed. It's still there because distinct chapters focus on particular rituals. But what the last two chapters I wrote, well, the last chapter I wrote, I think, is the one that I'm actually most, I think, is one of the best chapters in the book, which is the one that contains the stories of the different church members. It's you know, the one where I talk about the play and the songs that are in the play, but then I contrast it with the different stories of the church members. And I think that's how I realized that I needed to have people. I needed to have more people and more stories like that in the text.
Well, Dr. Brennan, we've taken up, I think, enough of your time. But before we end, I would like to sort of ask one more question, and that's kind of what you're working on currently, which you've already sort of hinted at, but perhaps you can kind of expand upon.
Yeah, so I have I have two projects in particular that are emerging out of this or connected to this research. The first comes directly out of it, which is right now what I'm trying to do is finish up a manuscript on Yoruba gospel music that's looking at commercially recorded and distributed Christian music by Yoruba Christian artists. That's not just, what I'm interested in this for this book is not about music in the context of church worship itself, but about the sort of system of recording and distribution and celebrity that is associated with it. So that's the book that I'm on sabbatical right now. So I'm trying to finish writing that manuscript. And it features sort of case studies of specific Yoruba gospel musicians like Tope Alabi or Yinka Yefele, and thinking further, expanding the arguments about media, technology, circulation, and celebrity, the way that they're impacted by and impacting on religiosity and religious piety. The other project that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I've just started doing the research for it, is a project that's about listening to religion in Lagos. That's not focused on music explicitly, but it's about sound and the role that sound plays in urban experience and the way that religious sounds impact people's experience of the city, but also people's religiosity. And so I see that as a very big, long-term, multi-stage project, but it'll involve a variety of field recordings of places in Lagos where religion is heard or perhaps not heard, in an attempt to understand, Lagos is fascinating to me, so I can come up with lots of different ways of understanding, thinking about, researching, writing about Lagos.
All right. Well, both of those sound really interesting, and I look forward to reading the next book. Thanks so much for doing this interview.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Thanks for your great questions, and thanks for reading my book.